I'm white. And my descendants, as far as I know, are all white. How comfortable are you using the word white to describe yourself or someone else? It can be a bit uncomfortable if you haven't done it very much. So, hi, I'm Deborah, and I'm white. Or ivory or pink or whatever. I invite you to try it. Yeah, people don't want to. I'm still going to invite you to try it. Hi, I'm Deborah, and I'm white. For those who are, because we're not all here, try it. Yeah. I thank you for that, for trying it. How does it feel? Okay, strange, uncomfortable. I'm sure there's a spectrum of reactions. So when I was in theological school, one of the exercises that we were asked to do was to take a piece of text. It was from a novel, and I can't remember exactly which one, and to take that text and rewrite it with the descriptor every time they mentioned somebody, that it would be, so Harold the white man, or white Steve, or white Jane. So we did that as an exercise and then read it again out loud. And for me, there was this huge shift of learning that white was hidden. It was an assumption in our world. So, first lesson. Growing up, I was really oblivious to the color of my skin because I lived in a white community. Or if there were people of color, I didn't really acknowledge it until I was 13 and my family moved to a different city and I had my first black-skinned friend. And she was wonderful and beautiful and exotic. She was new to me. Different. A generation later, my daughters going to school went to a school in Vancouver here where there was a spectrum of color, at least in the students, not so much in the teachers or in the upper echelons of the school. A generation next, the next generation, that's begun to change. White, black, yellow, brown, pink, red, cinnamon, ivory, chocolate, butterscotch, all are beautiful. And we know that race is a construct, that 99% of our DNA, every human being's is similar. 99.99%, that 1.0%, 0.01%, thank you, that is different is how we can trace our heredity. But today, what I'm talking about is not race, not the race of the color of our skin, but of the powerful social construction called whiteness. In her article in the Globe and Mail in October of 2016, Denise Balkensoon said, "Western society maintains that racism is an act that individuals do, not a system that all of us exist in." A system that all of us exist in. North America is a culture of whiteness, a system so pervasive it's like a fish in a bowl of water. And white people barely notice from day to day that they are swimming in this bowl of whiteness. We haven't needed to. White people don't need to. We haven't needed to. So how has this whiteness pervaded the culture? You know, it's very simple, right? A few hundred years back, Europeans came to North America. They took control of the land, the government, the economy, They built a country called Canada, and the people who had the most amount of power and made most of the decisions were white. Government was run by white people. Business was run by white people. The education and the churches, they were all run by white people for the most part. Therefore, that culture of whiteness is created by both conscious and at times unconscious values, belief systems, moral perspectives, and historical experiences, which then get filtered into the institutions that we build. Canadian institutions reflect white culture because white culture created them. It's just that simple. The challenge, if you are white, is seeing that reality and how it affects non-white Canadians. Because non-white Canadians, they see it all the time. They have to negotiate it every single day. They're making choices. Do I go into the white culture? Do I switch to my culture or another culture? It's like, you know, this is an analogy, I don't know how strong it is, but when you were a little child and you went to somebody else's house for dinner and you saw how a different family did things. Perhaps at the other house, the mother was in charge of serving the food, whereas in your house, your father always served the food, right? Or maybe in the other family, when they sat down to a meal, everybody was talking all the time, laughing, jokes, arguments. But in your house, only one person at a time was allowed to talk at meals. Each family and each culture create a way of doing things that just become the norm. And then we assume that everyone does it or sees it as we do, unless we get to go into our neighbor's home and see a different way of having dinner together. Not only do we think that everyone does life the way we did in our family, but we think our way is the only right way. And there is something wrong or suspect about the way others have dinner. This is what happens in a culture of white supremacy. When one dominant group of people have their right way of doing things, and they think that it's pretty obvious to them that it's the best way of doing things. And they institutionalize those good ways of doing things. And therefore we get a whiteness of culture. Now, as Unitarians, we have the touchstone of our principles to inspire and guide us and deepen our lives. We lean into these principles for personal comfort or spiritual growth, but we also lean into them for encouragement and support when our world needs to change, when we need to step out of what is known and comfortable into something that is new and maybe perhaps uncomfortable. The first principle, the affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of every person, could be enough on its own to inspire us to do the challenging work of racial self-reflection. We also have the principle that we uphold justice and compassion and equity in our relationships, and we even affirm and say we promote a world community made up of peace, freedom, and justice. These are the religious foundations on which we stand to look at white supremacy, how whiteness is built into our expectations of normal and into our institutions. And perhaps we lean into them to help us commit to the equalizing of all peoples in our institutions. In the Unitarian Universalist Association, which is the American counterpart to the Canadian Unitarian Council, our American brothers and sisters have for decades been focused on doing the work of culture changing around race and racism. Recently, a light has been shed on the institutionalizing of whiteness in the UU structure itself. The light was focused on the reality that there were very, very few upper-level decision-making jobs in the UUA that were being held by people of color. If this was the case, then the institution was still making decisions through the lens of whiteness. How the institution was structured, the way the decisions were made, the questions raised, the visions created, everything that made the institution what it was still being influenced through that lens. To that, there has been a tsunami of reaction. And that organization, and we are influenced by it here in Canada, by much as we are by much of what happens south of the border. The UUA is in deep transformation, and it's hard. It's really painful to shift an institution. There has been a call for white supremacy teach-ins across the denomination, and well over 500 congregations have responded to teach themselves about what is this white supremacy, and how is it affecting us, and how do we change it? Remember that moment, switching back to Canada, when the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, introduced his first gender equal cabinet and said, when he was challenged by it with a shrug, he said, well, it's 2016. So too, the Unitarian Universalist Association is redressing the racial imbalance in its organization. It's 2017. Not everyone sees that racial inequality is a problem in the UUA. There has been a black president of it, a Hispanic president, and yet they also see that one leader does not change a whole institution. We all have blinders to remove and lessons to learn. And if we are committed and inspired by our principles, we'll do it. So let's bring these examples of culture of whiteness closer to home. The Courier, this week, arrived at my door. There's an article about discrimination in the Bangra scene in the Lower Mainland. Tarun Nair of the fantastic band Delhi to Dublin has just made a film called Bangra City, in which he points out that the institutional racism in the music industry in Canada, BC, and the Lower Mainland is alive and well. He says, quote, "It's great that we can talk about racism now in North America. People realize that it's a legitimate concern. But," and there is a but, "there are subcultures burgeoning in different parts of the Lower Mainland that then hit invisible walls of discrimination. Despite the huge demand for Bangra music south of the Fraser, it is relatively invisible and inaudible in Vancouver clubs." So we may be able to talk about racism in some parts of our country, not all, of course, but talking about institutionalized whiteness, that's much more challenging. Often the walls of reactive fear create its own problems. Recently, the Toronto mayor, John Tory, at an election campaign event 2 years ago, demurred on whether white privilege existed. While in Ottawa, the mayor, Jim Watson, recently called those who accused him of white supremacy as being vulgar and rude. Interesting words to use. I'm not sure he really understood what it meant, but that's my opinion. The mayor of Calgary has a very different response. Naheed Nenshi, the first Muslim mayor in Canada, many of you I'm sure know him, participated in the Calgary Economic Development Series. He was a speaker for it in January, in which he spoke about diversity in Calgary. In particular, he noted that although the city employs a diverse workforce, the people in the upper management levels don't reflect that diversity. And his words created a huge controversy. His statement, he says, "We are lousy at promoting a diverse workforce. When you look at our management levels within the city, my top six managers, there's no women right now. The one woman retired. There are no people of a visible minority. Throughout our 34 next most senior managers at the city, I haven't actually done the census, but off the top of my head, I can think of only one person from a visible minority and a handful of women. We've got to do a better job," he says. "And we have to look internally at our own organization to determine what are the barriers that are in place towards people getting promoted into these jobs. These barriers are the barriers created by a system of white supremacy, unconscious, unexamined systems of whiteness. Remember that fish swimming in its bowl of water. White supremacy, for some, is the air that is breathed. And we are good people. But even good people can participate in structures that do not live up to our Unitarian principles, principles of equality and justice and the inherent worth and dignity of every single person. Whiteness exists, and I suggest that our religious work is to strengthen our resolve to see it and name it and commit to creating a new institutional structure that universally incorporates those principles. We begin by becoming aware of the whiteness that we live in, the normal in which we swim. Celebrating our gender diversity, our sexual diversity, our racial diversity is wonderful. Do not stop. But now we've got to look at the systems that create this whiteness. So we got to talk about it. But please first don't go and talk to a person of color about it. Their experience will be different than yours. They know about it. Talk to other white people about it. Learn together where your blinders are. What is it that you take for granted and don't realize the impact that it has on other people? I think sometimes it's a matter of bravery, getting past that first uncomfortableness. The more you do it, the more comfortable you'll get, and the deeper you'll go in understanding this fishbowl that many of us here swim in. I think that is something to celebrate. Thank you for listening.